Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up the world, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge with a fresh new start. They never will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
That introduction is compliments of Rachel and Michael from Trinity House Entertainment Inc. And they will be on my show October 2nd with all their new inspirational music that makes me smile on a rainy day. MJ Network, which stands for Marcia Joyce in Memory of My Sister, welcomes author J. Allen Wolfram, and the book is called Selected. And my show is for listeners who want to learn more about these phenomenal authors that I have honored to read their books and interview. Any comments that pertain to the book on my Facebook wall, feel free. If it has nothing to do with the book, well, please don't ask it. Within the world, there's a group that would like to control the world's population and have autonomy over the military resources and economic decisions and literally obliterating democracy. That's not good. The political arena has changed and there is no longer an election process decided by the people. Every 2 years, a president is selected from the list, and the author of this fantastic book is here. Good morning. How are you? And welcome to MJ Network.
I'm doing great, friend. Thank you for having me on.
This is so cool. So how did you create a situation where the American people lose their power to elect the president? And in a sense, we don't decide, they do. And what happened to the Electoral College and the votes?
That is an interesting question. So the way I came up with the idea for the book was during the last presidential election. You know, me and my wife were listening to the debates, and we got kind of tired of the whole political cycle of news. And you know, I made kind of an offhand comment to my wife of, "Well, what if we just pick someone at random? Like, could they do any worse than this?" And honestly, that's where the premise for the book came. So it really wasn't anything sinister. It was just more of a strange comment that I had in my head. And that sort of stuck with me. And that gave me the idea for the book. And this is the first book I've ever written. And this is actually the first time I've ever even tried to write fiction. So it was an interesting ride from the very beginning to actually finishing a full length novel. And again, most of the credit goes to my wife, though, because when I first started, it was rough. Chapter one was not fantastic on the first draft, and you know, she read, you know, probably the first 10 chapters as I wrote them, and it was really nice to be able to have that feedback from someone of, hey, you know, I want to know what happens next, and that's really what got me going and kept me going throughout writing the book.
Oh, we have a listener. That's Marcia Casper Cook, who's the author of many books, and she's listening. Hi, Marcia. And that's okay. So in a place like this, in a situation like this, and Susan Turner is the new president, we're going to talk about that, who is really running the government? Is it the president, or is it somebody pulling strings?
That is a fantastic question. So whenever I started writing the book, my intention really was to make it more of about the process of, you know, what happens within the government whenever, you know, officials are selected at random. But it really turned out to be a little bit different than that. But as you can tell, like if you read the book, there's the vice president who's been around, and that's the idea is that person is kind of the one with the experience. The vice president, the previous president sticks around to be the vice president, and they have a little bit of experience. But, you know, in this instance, Vice President Wilkes is actually getting blackmailed and controlled by another group called the board. So that's So although presidents and, you know, officials are selected at random, there's really that outside mm-hmm. influence still. It still is dirty politics, just as if they got elected. So it's kind of an interesting twist on that. Of it's very
yeah.
different, but also somewhat the same in terms of elected officials getting manipulated.
I wonder what would happen if that really happened today. That'd be interesting.
I don't know. So that was, you know, we were talking just a little bit earlier about there being a sequel and a prequel. So I've started to write mm-hmm. the prequel and try to come up with the idea of, well, what would it really take for something like that to happen? You know,
yeah.
Although I feel like, at least from my perspective, like I'm not old enough to have lived through any real political revolutions. But mm-hmm. things like that happen throughout history, and we take it for granted in the United States that
yeah.
it hasn't happened in a long time. Things have been fairly, you know, smooth and, you know, running, you know, everybody's pretty happy. But, you know, that has not been the case throughout history. Things happen. And when I was researching this book, there's actually a precedent for elected officials being selected at random. So in Rome, they had a style of government like this for a while.
Oh, wow.
And I forget the name of it. If I Google it real quick, maybe I can come up with it. But there is an actual historical precedent for
mm-hmm.
selecting officials at random, which is interesting.
That's interesting.
That was kind of a rambling answer to your question.
I often wonder, though, like, some of these people that get elected, that when the electoral votes are more and the popular votes are more and the electoral votes are less, that the person should really get the popular vote. That's, you know, why are we voting? Scary. But we have a vice president in this, and why did he decide to become the vice president? The president decided to become the vice president. What was his rationale for remaining in the White House? We'll just tell a little bit of that.
Yeah. So I think that's part of the organizational structure, which I probably didn't do a great job of explaining in the book, but part of that structure is that once you're the president, you stick around to be the vice president, just as kind of that person who's been around for a couple of years, you understand what's going on, and you can give some guidance to the new president. Because if you think about the way officials are elected now, they're around for, you know, I'm not even sure if there's term limits for Congress and senators. So there's that institutional knowledge that gets carried over from election to election. And the idea of the president sticking around to be the vice president and kind of help out with some of that institutional knowledge.
Well, if you read the news, you never know what we're going to read. So tell us about, Mason Adams. And how come he doesn't like Susan? And she was really, it was amazing because her son was like so excited. Oh, my God, my mother's going to be president of the United States. You might live to regret that, people. Seriously.
Yeah. So I think, you know, that role is more, not necessarily that there's anything inherently bad between them. It's just more of, you know, he's someone who's been around in the government for a while, and to see brand new people come in into a position of power is not something everyone's excited to see. And especially maybe if your personalities don't mesh right away. So I think the general idea of Susan is that, you know, she was in the Army before, she was a helicopter pilot. So she's got, you know, a familiarity with government organizations and just the way things work within the military and the government in general. So whenever she takes over the job, she kind of feels like, hey, I've got a handle on this. Like, I can do it. You know, I've done this before. This is just kind of me stepping back into an old role, which she quickly finds out is really not the case. It's much more complicated when you're the leader of the free world than it is whenever you're leading a helicopter combat unit.
Mm.
It's a little different.
So she has
to figure that out kind of on the job. And I feel like that's where a lot of the tension between those two comes from.
Well, Cheryl's here. Hi, Cheryl. We're all here today. So tell us about the Russian president and his agenda.
Yeah. Yeah. So the the idea is that the Russian president is really not so much different than what's happening in the current state. And there's a lot of parallels there. And part of it is really trying to set up a natural gas pipeline between the Ukraine and all the way up to Latvia.
Yeah.
So essentially it's very similar to what's happening now and how the Russian president is going to use that as leverage to kind of try to expand his control in Eastern Europe. So that's kind of an interesting dynamic of and a parallel to what's currently going on, I think. So that was my general idea there, was to try to parallel somewhat of what's happening in real life, but make it definitely a piece of fiction too.
Well, this is, as an educator, that's me, 36 years in one school, and not counting anymore, but I still do advise people. We have Jones, and who really isn't Jones. And how does he get into Greg's school, and what happened? And why didn't he? Because I know that if a parent came to see me as the dean or the assistant principal or whatever, I make sure that that the child knew who the person was, and made sure that they didn't get in. So how come the school didn't check? And since Greg is the president's son, why didn't the Secret Service look closer? Because they could have kidnapped him. This kid was smart, though. He realized.
Yeah, exactly. So that was an interesting scene to write. I feel like I wrote that one a couple times. And the idea was that that he got into the school as being a contractor, essentially. So So it was kind of a roundabout way to get through security. So there was security at the school, but you know, as a contractor, it's a little easier to slip by. And I think he made a dry run, and then the actual attempt to kidnap him, but kidnap Susan's son, but he really couldn't go through with it. So it was kind of a moral dilemma for him, because he has kids, and he kind of saw in Susan's son's eyes of like, oh, that's my kid that I'm about to do this to, and I can't go through with it. And, you know, afterwards he realized what the consequences of, well, probably during it he realized what the consequences were of it, but it didn't turn out well for him. But it was one of those situations where he had a moral dilemma of what do I do here? Do I do the job that I was hired to do, or do I do the morally right thing? So that was a choice that he had to make and had to deal with the consequences of it. But yeah, that was a tough scene for me to write, because I struggle with trying to keep the suspense and kind of thrill aspect of the book, but I really don't like dark things very much, so I try to not have things to be ultra violent, which is tough sometimes to keep the suspense going without having kind of those dark moments in a book. So those are the hardest moments for me to go to as a writer. So I struggle with those quite a bit.
Well, I'll tell you something. After reading this book, I'm saying this could really happen, and you never know. So documents are leaked. What documents are leaked, and what does Susan do, and how does she deal with it? And when the mission to rescue the pilots turns tragic, she really falls apart, because she actually cares about what happened.
Yeah. So that was again part of, I feel like, a bigger kind of scene or sequence where when Susan really first gets into office, she feels like, hey, this is kind of old hat to me. I've been here before. I've done this. You know, I led a helicopter combat unit. I know what to do, right? I've met some of these people before. I've been in these meetings before. But now she's fully in charge. And she makes the decision to go in and rescue the pilot. And this is the first time where her control is tested, really. because she made a couple of decisions early on in her presidency that worked out just fine. And this is the first time she made a decision that didn't, and people's lives were on the line.
Yeah.
And people died because of it. So, and I feel like her being in this situation before and being the person who's on the ground or the person who's actually flying the helicopter, it's very difficult for her to deal with, you know, a decision gone wrong. So she has a lot of trouble reconciling the idea that she can't just do it alone. Maybe she does need actual, she needs to take advice from other people within the government. It's not just her dictating control and what should happen next. So that was an interesting sequence for me to write and think about, just the idea of, you know, whenever you do step into a new adventure, you might think you have things under control, but you've still got a lot to learn.
Well, I think the President of the United States needs to start asking for the advice of other people and try listening. Maybe they should learn from this book. You never know.
Yeah.
Just my personal...
Yeah, no, and, and I think, so the interesting thing is that, you know, I really didn't think about when I was writing this, I didn't think about the ramifications of, you know, writing a book about politics and the president and how I guess I would say outrageous like current politics are. So it's just an interesting parallel because I feel like there's been a couple of political TV shows that have been on. I don't know if you've ever seen House of Cards before, but that was hugely popular maybe like four or five years ago, and it was kind of a political drama. But I think part of the reason why it was so popular is that politics was boring at the time, like actual politics. Like everything was going great. President Obama was great. People were happy in general. I mean, there were some people who weren't. But things were generally kind of going along a nice path, and there was no real political outrage or news. So having a drama about political kind of scandal was great. But now things have kind of flipped, which is an interesting, I just feel like an interesting cultural perspective of, you know, the actual political drama is more interesting than what you could write. I feel like not more interesting because it's not good, but there's a lot more drama going on.
Well, I have to say that when I got this book, and basically Cheryl said, and she's listening, you know, would you like to interview the author? I said, I guess I'm going to have to read the book. Ha-ha, very funny. And I started to read it, and I'm saying, okay, wait a minute. And I'm reading this, and I got eye strain, which is a compliment, which is probably why, part of the reason why the other day, whatever. And, and I just put this down and said, wait a minute. I've read at least 8,000 books, seriously, in the last 8-9 years. And my husband counted them on my computer, and there's more now. And this was so original, I'm going like, wait a minute, I haven't read one like this yet, which made it even better because you get bored after a while. So you have this an organization that's very dangerous people, seriously, they're called the Board. What is their purpose, and what role does Anderson play? They are scary, and are you bringing them back next book too?
Yes. So the board is interesting. The board is definitely coming back, and they'll be in the prequel and in the sequel. But the general idea behind it is, you know, it comes from whether or not you believe it or not, but the weird conspiracy theory stuff of like the Illuminati or this like group of influential businessmen who actually control what's going on in the government and the world. So I don't necessarily believe in that in real life, but it's a thing that people think of, you know, is there some type of universal conspiracy that's, you know, moving the world in a certain direction to benefit themselves, right? And that's the idea behind the board is it's a group of influential business people who got together and said, okay, we want to influence politics in a way that benefits us. And when the government switched over to, there was a political revolution, obviously, and now the president and elected officials are selected at random. So they have to find a different way to influence politics, right? So they might not necessarily have, you know, senators and congressmen, you know, in their pockets. They're not donating to their campaigns, but they have to find a different way to get their agenda across. So that's the general idea behind the board. And Mr. Anderson, he is a former Army general. He's friends with General LeMay, who is my favorite character in the was
mm-hmm.
definitely my favorite
yeah.
character to write in the book. Only because I kept thinking of, like, when I think of General LeMay in the book, I think of I don't know if you've seen the show Mad Men, but Roger Slattery in Mad Men, the older, kind of tall, gray-haired, slim gentleman, like, that's who I think of as General LeMay a little bit. And also, General LeMay is actually based on a real Air Force general. During World War II, the leader of the Air Force was General Curtis LeMay, and that's where I kind of came up with the name and a little bit of the character background. That was a lot of rambling. Back to the board, though. So Mr. Anderson's son was actually killed in combat, and that affected
yeah.
him. And he really kind of got disenfranchised with the military and the Army, and he went into the private sector, private industry, and he got associated with this group of people that he later knew as the board. And just like he did in the military and started to rise up through the ranks, and he ended up being elected as the chief operating officer of this board, and it's his job to kind of carry out their instructions. And that's how him and Mr. Anderson ended up kind of blackmailing Vice President Wilkes and keeping him under his control. Yeah.
Well, he decided, this is so scary. I put three questions in together. He refers to it as the United Peace and World. If that happened today, oh my God. And what his plan or ideology he thinks would happen, he wants to take over all the countries of the world and be the primary ruler, doesn't he? And take
yes.
over everything.
Absolutely.
Oh, could you imagine a whole bunch of people like the president of Korea or worse? that would be worse
yes.
than that.
Yes. No, it's a horrible alternative, right? So the real idea is that Susan as the protagonist and Mr. Anderson as the antagonist are really direct opposites
yeah.
of each other. So they really both want peace in the world, but they have a very, very different way of potentially going about it.
Yeah.
Right? So Mr. Anderson wants complete control over everything and thinks that that truly is the way that peace is going to happen, which, I mean, throughout history, many, many dictators have had the same opinion of if I controlled everything, you know, everything would be fine. It'd be the end to war, right? And that's, you know, I feel like the backbone of quite a few different thrillers and dramas of if I was in complete control, then there would be no wars anymore and everything would be peaceful, which is not, it's just not true. And Susan's on the other side of things of like, hey, you know, we want peace, but I don't want complete control of everything to have it, right?
Mm.
And people should have their own free will. So that's the kind of opposite forces that I was trying to bring out between the protagonist and the antagonist in the book.
Oh, you did. And let me tell you, like I said, I got total eye strain reading this one because I kept reading it. I couldn't wait to see what was going to happen at the end. And I'm not going to say anything because I put the book over there because if I look at it, I might read the last page. Oh, my God. That's all I'm going to say. Yeah, for those of you that really want to get scared, read the last page of the book and you'll know it's not over yet. So who is Emily and what is her relation to Anderson? I felt so bad for her because he's not a nice person and he wants to get rid of her. Poor Emily. And what does
yeah.
she do that he requires? And she doesn't even ask questions. This poor thing needs to wise up.
Yeah, yeah. And that was really, that section was an attempt to kind
yeah.
of humanize Mr. Anderson, right? So in the book, he seems like he's this all-powerful, you know, unstoppable, you know, force,
yeah.
right? He's the perfect person who's in charge of this, you know, this group that's going to control the world. He's going to be the guy who controls the world. But really, he's just a person with his own flaws and his own personal relationships that aren't necessarily fantastic. And he's got his own secrets. So that was really, his relationship with Emily was more about trying to personalize him and show that, you know, he's not this, you know, this unfallible person. He does have flaws, just like everyone does. Everyone's got secrets that they don't want to tell. And he's no different. So that was my way of trying to get that across. And then, contrasting that with, you know, the interactions he has with his wife as well. So that was an interesting, and like, I really liked writing that, the scene where him and his wife go to the races. And that's kind of the perfect side of him. Showing that, hey, you and my wife, we own a racehorse won, everything's fantastic, you know, everything seems perfect. But that's not really true.
Well, if everybody would read the book, like me, as you can tell people I read it, and you go to chapter 38, make sure you have your tissues ready. Because Susan has this meltdown, which is human. I'm not sure how many presidents would do that. What and whom does she talk to in order to gain her strength? Because at this point she feels that maybe she's the wrong person for the job. So how does she get it back together again and realize that you're being manipulated, and don't let people manipulate you, because this is girl power, people. Seriously.
Yeah, and that's something that we haven't talked a little bit too much about Susan, and she also has an interesting and tough past, right? She's not a perfect person either.
Yeah,
So her husband was killed in combat. So they were both in the army. Her husband was killed in combat, and that caused an awful lot of problems for her before she became president in her personal life. And that was really a big part of her really not wanting to take on the responsibility of being the president after she was selected. So really in time of crisis, her rock of, you know, moral compass is really trying to communicate with her, not communicate, but think through the eyes of her husband who passed away. So that's the thing that brings her back to her moral center, is trying to think of the advice that he would give her. So that was an interesting scene where she kind of really realized that, wow, I'm being betrayed by the people that I thought were on my side, but they're not. So that means I need to step up and figure out who my true friends are and really listen to them and, you know, try to solve this problem.
Well, we want to learn more about these two, her sons. You know, kids are kids, and anybody messes with them in school, you mess with their mother, forget it, you punch them out. And as the dean of discipline in my school, and I'm little, very little, I had no problem, seriously. So tell us about her two sons, and what happens when Tommy gets into a fight in school, and why, and what does the agent assigned to him decide to do? And kids will fight, and like I said, as little as I am, and the kids were like 9 feet tall, I stopped it because I learned. I had some teachers in my school that were karate experts. They showed me what to do. And nobody ever got hurt, but I learned a long time ago how to defend myself. I was like, okay, you from the Bronx, you can do this. So tell us about her two sons and what happens when Tommy gets into a fight. What does the school do, and what happens, what does the agent do?
Yeah, it's an interesting, you know, scene as well. And this was another instance of me trying to get through the idea that the decisions that Susan makes as the president don't just affect her, right? So now she's on a world stage, and it's not all about her anymore. The things that she does really affect her family as well. And what happened was her son was getting bullied at school, essentially, and got into a fight because of decisions that she had made as a president. So it was an interesting way to, for me, I felt an interesting way to again, try to show the other side of what really happens, you know, if you're in a position of power and on a world stage, if you're a celebrity or someone who has a large amount of influence in popular culture, like the decisions you make and the actions you take really don't just affect you, they affect everyone around you as well. And I think that was kind of a reckoning moment to try to figure out, you know, wow, this is not always just about me. And also an opportunity to think through the idea that not everyone's going to agree with everything you do. And that's okay, right? There's no way to be a person in a position of power, whether you're a politician or a leader of a business or any other position of power, and make decisions that everyone's happy about. It's just not going to happen. But
I know.
People are going to be mad, right? Like, you know, that happens. But
yeah.
The idea of the decisions you make, you have to be morally okay with, right? Because people are going to be mad, and you're going to have to stand up in front of everyone and say, I did this. I did, you know, action X. I took that. And I did it for this reason. And I'm okay with that because it's the right thing to do. You might not like it, but it's the right thing to do. So that scene was kind of my attempt to portray that, I really appreciate these questions because I think the book was published in like January, so it's good to go back through all of these scenes and think about, you know, the reason of why I wrote them. This is fun.
Well, before I forget, we don't want to forget. Yesterday's show was supposed to be an hour, and the reason I moved it to Monday is because I couldn't do an hour. So I moved it to Monday, and it's going to be author Dawn C. Reed, California Cures. We're going to talk about stem cell research. I can't wait to do that. On the 5th, Alice Rosenfeld is back with Body in the Ballroom. You just watch out for her. And somebody that is really fantastic, David McAuliffe, Recon, on Wednesday. The week after, on the 12th, T.J. O'Connor, the consultant, and on the 13th, Marilyn Levinson, read to write her library murder mystery. On the 17th, Flight of the Fox, and on the 20th, the head writer of Murder, She Wrote, Tom Sawyer, with a Barney Moon novel. On the 25th, Nancy Allen, the juror number 3 with James Patterson. And on the 27th, I'm doing something very different. I'm doing the show with someone that has multiple sclerosis. And we're going to talk about it in depth. And on the 14th, I'm going to be interviewed on 98.1 FM, 1270 AM for my book, A Daughter's Promise, open mic. And I don't know what they're going to ask, but I'm sure I'll get through it. And that's just some of what's coming up next month. There's a whole lot more coming up in October. So who is Gillingham, and what does he explain to Anderson? What is the ultimate plan or goal? God, if this really happened and this book really takes place, it could be a series on television, seriously, and scare everybody.
Yeah, so Admiral Gillingham is the chief of staff, and in charge of the military, essentially, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And him and Mr. Anderson have a past. They knew each other from their time in the military. So Mr. Anderson is outside of the government, outside of the military, you know, theoretically completely separated from this whole process. But Mr. Anderson owns a government contracting company that does a ton of business with the government. So he has a reason to be around the Pentagon and really have a lot of influence and access to high-ranking military officials. So it's part of his day-to-day thing as a government contractor and being the owner of that company. He talks to, you know, leading military officials all the time. They're talking about business. But in this case, business isn't necessarily, you know, above board, you know, nice things trying to help people, right? There's a sinister background to it. And really what Mr. Anderson is trying to do through Admiral Gillingham is use the government contract that he has to try to basically spark a conflict between Russia and, or the Soviet Union and the United States, right? So it's an interesting way to, for Mr. Anderson to really have an awful lot of influence over some big events, but not really be in an official position of power. He's kind of on the side manipulating things in a very tense situation between Russia and the United States. Which, again, you're right, Fran. Like, it's not an awful lot different than the level of control that some of the government contracting companies hold now. And, you know, we all hope that they're doing things with the best of intentions, but, you know, may or may not be true all the time. So it's very scary. Like, letting those, the scenes where they're in the Pentagon together was interesting. I've never actually been in the Pentagon. I've been in some government buildings before, but I've never been in the Pentagon. But, you know, I did as much research as I could to figure out what it looks like in there and kind of how things are set up. And it is a very interesting place for sure, because it's obviously one of the most secure places in the world, but there's an awful lot of very influential decisions that happen there. So that was, I felt like, a great place for them to have kind of that final meeting where they were trying to do some not very good things. And just like in real life, there was a, you know, a quid pro quo situation where Mr. Anderson was like, hey, when I become the, you know, when I start running the show of the world, you know, Admiral Gillingham, you know, I want you with me. So, you know, there's something in it for you in the end as well. So it was just interesting to see that, for me, to see that play out, like that interaction between those two groups of people, and where Mr. Anderson truly has no, on paper, power. He's not someone in charge. You don't see him on the organizational chart, but he's really in control of major world events. So that was interesting.
That's scary. I'll tell you, I would love to be in one of their meetings, just to be a fly on the wall, just to hear what they really say, just to see if anything really ever gets done. I mean, the closest I ever got was when I was teaching sixth grade, because I had the greatest kids in the world, and we went to the United Nations, and we were one of the few classes invited into the General Assembly. And they actually called the school to tell the principal that they were amazing. So they must have done something right. But, yeah, it was interesting. But what happens when the president of Russia is no longer alive and someone else is in charge? And how does China come into play? Because the relationship between the United States changed. And why would they even speak to Susan at that point? Because everything changed at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, right. So the president, the Russian president, dies. Well, or is murdered, maybe.
Somebody didn't want him around because he was doing a good job. What can you do? You do a good job, you get eliminated. Watch out.
Yeah, exactly. So, again, another instance of Mr. Anderson really controlling major events, but not having an official position on, you know, the world leader chart. Interesting. So the person who takes over is the former, basically, chief of the KGB, and also a sympathizer of Mr. Anderson, right? He has his own agenda, the person who takes over, but he also, you know, takes orders and or really kind of wants to work with Mr. Anderson. So again, another scenario of Mr. Anderson kind of playing both sides, right? So he wants the Russian president and the new Russian president to really kind of be friends with him, but really he's trying to manipulate them into a conflict with the United States, right? And then the idea is that if that conflict with the United States happens, you know, there's going to be an extreme amount of chaos that comes from that situation, right? That that would bring chaos to the entire world. And that's Mr. Anderson's general plan, is like, how do we make the world as chaotic as possible for a short period of time? And out of that chaos, the board will emerge as the people who bring order back to the chaos.
Oh, God.
And they'll be in control. That's the big plan of the board, is that it, from their perspective, it's okay to generate chaos, an extreme amount of chaos for a short period of time, and a lot of people will die, but in the end, we're going to bring order to that chaos, and things will be much better when the world is under our control and our type of order than it is currently. So that's the bigger picture of plan, right? And Susan kind of figures out what's going on. She's like, whoa, this is a bad situation. And it's where Susan really comes around full circle from whenever she first started at the White House. Like, the idea that I really tried to get across was, she feels very comfortable here as the president. Like, she dictates orders to people, and they carry out her orders, and that's how things work. Like, I tell people what to do, they do it, everything is fine. I don't need help from anybody else. No one's going to question anything I say. I'm in charge, do what I say. And that's not really how things work. And it works like that in the military to a certain extent. I've been in the military. I'm a former Marine. I understand what taking orders means and giving orders. That's the way it works. But that's not how international diplomacy works, right? So the President of the United States can't just order the President of Russia to do something. Like, that doesn't work like that, right? And there's a couple of scenes in the book where Susan tries to do that throughout the middle. Mm-hmm. She tries to dictate orders to the Russian ambassador, and it doesn't work. It backfires on it. So in the end, she really has to come full circle and learn that, you know, in order to make things happen in the world of international diplomacy, people are motivated by their own self-interest. So you have to phrase things in a way that everyone will be happy, right? It will benefit, what you're trying to accomplish has to benefit everyone involved. It can't be you dictating orders to people. You have to set up a scenario where there's an opportunity for people to collaborate, and all the collaborators will gain something from it. Mm-hmm. You know, that's really the only way to get anything accomplished. I believe in that concept, right? But, you know, and that, I think, applies to personal life too, right? So, like, if I try to dictate orders to my wife, like, that's not going to work like that.
I would imagine that would work, no.
No. But having that kind of mutual understanding that we're both going to be better off by this decision, and that's how Susan gets the Chinese government involved, is she realizes what's happening, and she doesn't really have a way to give an appealing alternative to the Russian president to get him to do what she thinks is best. So she brings in another entity, which is the Chinese government, which is really kind of an outside-the-box thought on her part of how do we get another country involved that also will mutually benefit to try to accomplish something that's going to bring us back to, you know, at least a cordial agreement between all these countries, right? Because things have gotten, at that point, things have gotten very chaotic between the Russian government and the United States government and the military, right? They're very close to
sparking a conflict, right? There's been some skirmishes towards the border. You know, pilots were shot down and captured. Like, things have happened, and it's getting very close to there being a spark to a conflict between the two countries, which is bad. So there's a lot of chaos happening towards the border there, and what Susan's trying to do is try to bring some order back to this chaos so that we're not both, you know, the Russian president and the United States president aren't, you know, sitting at their desk with their finger on the red button to start a war. And that was really the idea between that agreement, is how do we come together as multiple countries and have more of a cordial business relationship that we all want to come out well. Because there's problems within Russia that the Russian president has to deal with, right? They've got serious economic problems happening, and he needs a way to basically be able to feed the people of Russia, right? So, or he's going to have an uprising in Russia, and he's going to have a problem, you know, staying in power if that happens, right? So there's conflicting interests on the Russian side too. So there's a lot going on, but the general idea is how do we set up an environment where everyone gains something, and we bring a little bit of order back to the chaotic kind of tense environment that's happened.
Well, we have we have a few books that everybody should read, starting with this one. If you haven't read The Selected, Christmas and Hanukkah are coming up very soon. So I would get 1 million copies and start reading. Andrew Gross, Button Man. It's about the garment industry and about a 12-year-old child that quits school and becomes a millionaire. I won't tell you how. Body in the Ballroom, and that's fantastic. That comes out next week. Beyond the Truth by one of my favorite people, Bruce Coffin, and The Three Beths by Jeff Abbott, and one of our books on partners in crime, Criminal Misdeeds. Ooh, you want to read all these books, seriously. So, we have General Lamere, and we have a couple more minutes. How does he help Susan gain control, and why does she trust him? I mean, seriously, I don't trust anybody in this book after a while.
Yeah, so General LeMay, again, kind of one of my favorite characters in the book. So he is actually one of Susan's former squadron commanders when he was in the Army. So, and that's where their relationship really started, was, you know, he was basically Susan's boss in the Army, and she has an awful lot of respect for him. So this guy, he's been around for a while. He's the old gray-haired general who's been around through multiple wars, kind of seen everything, and it was really at one point probably a mentor to Susan. So, but he's also not infallible himself, but Susan really trusts him as her mentor in this new situation as well. So I think there is, and I didn't, in the sequel it will get explored a little bit more, but there's a little bit more to General LeMay than there seems to be on the outside. Because, you know, you have to kind of think, how does someone stick around in the government for that long and maintain a position of power, right? It can't be because you're squeaky clean and everybody just really likes you. There's got to be some secrets behind that situation as well. It's kind
of course.
The parallel I like to think of is, like, if you're the CEO of like a Fortune 500 company, like, you didn't get there because you're the nicest person in the world. You stepped on some people's backs to make that happen. Like, that's just the way things work. So it's interesting to think about his background, but he also has really a strong bond with Susan and is a trusted advisor of hers, and that's why she trusts him and brings him along to, you know, that final meeting in Geneva where all the countries get together.
and really listens to his advice throughout her, really from the beginning of being selected as president, you know, through the end, you know, he's really the person that she leans on. And, you know, for good reason. Like, he gives good advice, and he's been around, and he's done that, and he's seen it before. But again, there's a dark side to everyone, or a not so rosy past to everyone as well. But yeah, that was one of my favorite characters, because he's, you know, kind of like that grizzled old, you know, Air Force general who, you know, everyone kind of looks to in the room for advice whenever there's a tough question. You know, he's that guy.
Well, I guess you're going to bring him back then, because as I read the last page, and that was all I'll say about that, there's definitely going to be a sequel, people, and the board won't give up. So tell us a little about, we have about 5 more minutes, what's next for you, and a little bit about the next book, and when is it coming out, and when am I getting it? Seriously.
I wish I could promise a date. I'm trying. No promises on a date, but the next book is definitely coming, because at the end of this, you know, Susan is able to kind of really to stop the board's plan, but she doesn't stop the board in general. And
yeah, I know.
Right? Yeah, so really the next book is going to be about how you take down Mr. Anderson and the board. And that's a tough thing, because really they're so embedded within the government and within society that's a really tough task. And just a little bit about, you know, so whenever I wrote this book, again, my first attempt at writing anything fiction, I really didn't understand that what I ended up writing was really the middle book of 3, which leaves a lot of open ends on the beginning and the end. So I've done some work planning out the prequel, which really will be about the political instability that happens when a political revolution happens. So, like, what really would have to happen in society? What would trigger things getting bad enough to the point where people said, hey, I don't trust the way we're electing government officials anymore, and we have to figure out a better way. I don't know exactly how that's going to happen, but I have a plan for it.
I think you better ask your wife to read it. I think you better ask your wife to read it. She'll tell you. Trust me, she knows. I wish I had somebody to read. I have written 19 books and had my magazine and everything. He hasn't read one. Very sad. That's why I miss my sister, who the network is named after, because she used to critique me terribly, and that was good. And she would say, you don't know what you're doing. You need to change that. My first 3 books were about ourselves growing up in the South Bronx and our antics. And she told everybody after she read it, my sister must have been adopted because I don't remember all that. I said, really? I said, no, my mother insisted that I get all A's. So if I didn't get 100 on the test, I had to write the whole thing over, even if it was 99, seriously. So, you know, I began to wonder, maybe she's got a point there. No wonder my mother told me that I was younger, and I really am, and it doesn't really matter. So before we end, where can we find out more about you and your work and everybody? Where can we get 1 million copies of this book? And the nurse in my doctor's office, all 20,000 people want to read this, so I guess I'm going to give it up soon, maybe. No, make them buy it themselves. I give away books in my building to the porters, to everybody, and I'll walk in the elevator. She's here. What do you have? So I know that there are going to be people that are going to want to read this. So where can we find out more about you and your work, and where can everybody get 1 million copies of this book?
Yeah, so the book is available on Amazon. There's an ebook and a paperback. And if you want to know more about me and what I've been up to, I have a website. It's jallenwolfram.com. It's J-A-L-L-E-N-W-O-L-F-R-U-M.com. The weekly newsletter. I write a short story every week and send that out to everyone who signs up for the newsletter. And that's a great way to figure out what I'm doing and what I'm up to and stay up to date with me. And I actually have a bunch of copies at my house of the book. So if anyone listening wants a free copy, send me an email and I'll send one out to you. Until I run out of
very,
how many
good.
I've got. I think I've got 25 or so. But
that is great. But I think everybody should go to Amazon because we, you know, it helps. What can I say? So I want to thank you a million times, and I do hope you're going to do another blog tour with Partners in Crime. If I ever get done writing my next book, I'll be doing it with the other Half Providence books, which is fantastic. And without Cheryl and Gina and Wendy to keep me busy all the time, I don't know what I would be doing. Yeah, I would probably do more. No. And I'm so happy that this interview came. This was a lot of fun, I have to tell you. Everybody that hasn't read this selected, I don't know what you're waiting for. Everybody, thank you so much. This has been fantastic. It's raining outside. The sun forgot to shine today, but that's okay. Everybody have a nice day. And I will be back on Monday with author Don C. Reed, California Cures, and we're going to talk about Alzheimer's and other diseases that there are cures for and funding has been eliminated. And since my mom was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and that's what my book, A Daughter's Promise, is about, that they're going to interview me about on the 14th, I'm very interested to know more about it. So everybody have a nice day. Jared, thank you so much. Everybody have a great day, and bye.
Thank you, Beth.